Chairs. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that doesn't mind the occasional acronym YOLO, FOMO, and OMG. It's Motley Fool Money. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me is Anirvan Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
G'day, Captain.
That is possibly my very worst open, but stay with us, fools, because we're going to plow through some really great content. As I mentioned last week, if this is your first time listening, firstly, thank you. We appreciate it. Go back and have a listen to some of our other podcasts, if you will. But if you were here last week, you will know that right now I'm nearing the end of my eight-day trek on the Kokoda track through the PNG jungle. Hopefully I'm not medevaced somewhere or laying beside the track. Hopefully it's all going very, very well and I'm having a wonderful time. But we didn't want to leave you without a podcast this week. And so what we thought we'd do is some of our favourite stuff. We're going to dip into some of the concepts and ideas we think you investors need to know. All investors, we need to know as well and remind ourselves. And as I like to say, as most people like to say, the best way to learn is to teach. So we're going to be teaching ourselves as well as hopefully teaching you a few things. And we might just dip into the full mailbag if we've got a little bit of time. Doc, I'm going to start with one of your very, very favorites. This one comes from our Motley Fool co-founder and co-chairman, David Gardner, our chief rule breaker, self-assigned, but certainly a title that he enjoys and we certainly like reminding him of. The old saw is that in investing, you should be buying low and selling high. You're going to try and convince me that buying for a low price and selling for a high price is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Is that really what you're going to do?
Yeah.
All right. You've mentioned this before. I'm this is theatrical pausing, of course, because I do know exactly what you're going to say, and I agree with it. But we will keep the facade, the theater of the mind going. If it's not buy low, sell high. What is it?
So one of the common things people do is people look at their portfolio.
Yes. I've done that before.
You know, everybody,
that's common.
You know,
yes.
And you see winners and losers. You know, ones that have made money, ones that are not making money. The first, you know, instinctively, we feel that we should, you know, sell the winners.
Because, well, you made some money, right?
You made money. You feel good about
it.
Yeah,
risk that money.
And that's lovely. You know, you made some money. You can, you know, go buy your jeans and go buy your iPhones and do all sorts of good stuff. Buy your iPads, iPad Pros, whatever you want to do.
Oh, dear.
Teslas, etc. All the good things. Right?
So I'm pretty sure they're paying you for this stuff. But anyway, keep going.
I have shares. So, that's what you hold on to ones that have not made you money.
Right.
Because, you know, if you sell them, it's like declaring that you lost.
Oh, well, sell it. A loser, you got to wait till you make money, then you
exactly.
sell.
Exactly. You want to get even.
You're not selling. Right? You don't make losses, mate. You want to lock in the wins, not the losses.
Exactly. Now, this is the buy low, sell high. It's probably the worst advice that exists. Because
to be fair, it's better than buy low, sell lower.
Okay.
It's better than that.
Okay, maybe it's better than that.
So second worst. Can we agree on that?
Second worst. Right. Let's agree on the second worst. But it's like, you know, this is basically the straight ticket to not have multi-baggers.
Yep.
Why? Because, well, if something is going to 10-bag, the path to a 10-bagger is through a double, through a triple, through a quadruple, through a, you know, quintuple, and so on, right?
Right.
So if you do not let things go up over time, you're not going to get the 10-bagger.
Sure, but what if it goes up and then falls again? I'm better lock in a win than suffer a loss, aren't I?
Oh, well, if you want to, but, you know, things, you know, sometimes they don't go up in a straight line. They go up a little bit, then down, and then they go up like Amazon did. So those people who locked it, they only made so much. Mm-hmm. Those people who didn't lock it, they are sitting on, you know, ginormous amounts of, you know, 300x or 400x or whatever the amount was.
That qualifies as ginormous.
That qualifies
as ginormous. I'm pretty sure that's
so,
right.
So, I mean, what David would say is buy high.
Yes.
And buy higher. And this is very counterintuitive. There's logic to this.
Tell me the story. There's
a lot of logic to this. So, you know, when share prices go up, right, you know, you'd hear people saying, oh, this is overvalued and this is, you know, this has gone up too much and this is crazy. There's another way to think about that. The another way to think about that is a bunch of people are calling it overvalued.
Yep.
And it has gone up because another bunch of people have bid it up.
Yes.
Right. And therefore, somebody must be seeing something happening here. And if the shares have gone up, and if the results that you've seen in the past reflect that the company is making steady progress,
right,
this is a good sign.
And that's the key, right? It's the combination of both. We would never ever say you should buy anything just because of whatever the share price is doing, up or down, by the way.
Yeah, not momentum.
But if the shares are doing well and the company's doing well, then there's something kind of cool going on there.
Exactly.
Winners keep on.
Winning.
There you go.
Right. And if a company is, you know, just starting out, like think about 2008, 2009, yes. Apple just released the iPhone.
I remember that. That was painful.
It was, you know, such a painful event for you.
No, I mean on the market, not the Apple iPhone.
Okay.
I had an iPhone for a short period of time.
Man, you were on the good side.
And for a little bit.
Then you went dark. That's different. But think about this. You know, you saw the iPhone came out. People started, you know, making lines outside the Apple stores to buy these things, right?
I still don't understand those people, but anyway.
That's a great sign. Right. Consumers love it.
Yep.
Consumers want it. Every year, millions of them are being sold.
When you can create that much fandom, when you create that much rabid excitement about a phone, I love my gadgets, don't get me wrong, but I'm never, ever going to line up for one.
Yep.
When you can create as a company that sort of excitement,
Something is going on. And that's the time to pay attention, right? So at that point, the Apple shares might have gone up, you know, at that point, with reference to the past, maybe 2 or 3 or 4x, right? And you could say, oh, it's very high.
So a whole lot of people said, I'm going to lock that in. I put a couple of thousand in. I've made 5,000 of profits. I'm going to lock that in because I don't want to lose those $5,000. Yeah.
They have lost 16x if that held on from 2008 till now.
Okay. That's
painful. So I mean, you know, sometimes you just need to see the success of the business. Just sit tight. You know, sitting tight is very hard. So what? When we say buy high, it means, you know, the company is making progress. You can buy more.
Right, because it's demonstrating its success.
It's demonstrating success. Right. And typically, that's what I like to do is, you know, if a company is doing well and the share price has gone up, gives me more confidence, I buy some more at that time. You know, you could do, you know, some sort of dollar cost averaging. So you're buying less shares, less shares over time.
Yep.
But, you know, and if the shares fall, you could buy more shares over time. I really think that, you know, selling your winners is a bad idea. You pay tax, you pay brokerages and all sorts of things. You know, if you want to sell something, sell your losers maybe. As long as you don't believe in those businesses, then, you know, that's probably the one you want to sell, not the winners. So, this is bad advice.
I completely agree with you. I actually would take only slight exception to David's advice in the sense, for those who want to think purely rationally about this, and I'm not saying David's not being rational, by the way, the sense that you would buy higher, I would argue is actually irrelevant in the sense we talked about anchoring last week, and I would come back to that. Don't buy just because it's higher, but if we don't sell just because it's higher, and again, don't buy just because it's lower, right? The question is, okay, if you bought shares of Company X for $1 3 years ago, and that company's now 10 times more profitable today, and you still believe in its future, then of course the share price is going to be higher. And the whole idea of buying higher is basically saying don't not buy because it's higher. In other words, don't succumb to that natural human fear of not doing it. So I don't think you should buy because it's higher. I don't think you should buy because it's lower. I don't think you should buy with any reference at all personally to any past share price. So if you're being purely rational, purely homo economicus, as they say, purely rational man or rational person, you would say, I'm going to buy because it's worth buying at today's price. I think David is saying, don't feel like you should avoid it because the price is up. Because a lot of us do, right? Oh, I wish I'd bought it a year ago. The price was... I said this to you about Apple. I said, I should have bought Apple when you told me to $113. And you said to me, it's not too late. And that's exactly... that. Again, as I said, we you know, you're never going to get rid of these psychological biases. The best you can do is recognize them and act to avoid them or get around them. So, you know, yes, I think you're dead right. Buy higher because the business continues to do well. We mentioned corporate travel last week, and I will say, each of our recommendations, despite the fall of last week, are still well and truly up in the green. And each of our second and third recommendation we made for our members of Motley Fool Share Advisor were at higher prices. We've done exactly that. The business continued to do well. We continued to like it. We continued to think it was good value. And so we recommended people buy it at, I want to say, 240 and about 6 and then about 12, give or take. It would have been very easy at $12 to say, share price already up 4-5-fold. Surely it can't go any higher. Now, again, I'm in the middle of the jungle, so I don't know what the price is right now. But at the time of recording, it was still over $22. And so to some degree, that was remained the right thing to do because the future remained bright. And I think that, again, a little local example, Amazon, Apple, plenty of others in the US as well. That's the story we're looking for.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, let's go to another one. Mm-hmm. This is one of my, I won't rant about this, but it is one of my favorite hobby horses.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the idea of companies beating or missing estimates. Now, let me paint you the picture. We hear the report come through the news or an analyst report, or we're talking about it across the table somewhere and someone says, Woolworths beat estimates by 24 cents a share. Or Woolworths missed estimates by 12 cents a share.
Mm.
And I've got to say, and I know I'm among friends here, Doc. Mm. that is the most bizarre, banal, stupid approach to investing that is absolutely possible to pursue. Now, I will say there is a reason why it's at least appropriate to consider it.
Mm-hmm.
But first, what is wrong with saying Woolworths beat or missed estimates?
So the first thing that's wrong with that is that basically we are saying that what we care about is the estimates, the consensus, which is typically the average or the median of a bunch of analysts and what they think earnings or revenue should be.
Right.
Right.
And more importantly, Woolworths somehow should, because it's Woolworths that missed those estimates.
Yeah. If Woolworths didn't guide for something, the only thing they can miss is if they guide for something, right? Not what other people think they should be doing. So that's part. Now, I get the logic here. The logic here is that the analysts, supposedly, are supposed to know exactly what the company should do. They're the ones who are modeling the companies. Everybody has a very precise value that they assign to these companies, and therefore
not everybody. The other people. Those guys.
Those guys.
We don't do that.
Yeah,
but
those guys do that. Yeah. So when I say everybody, I'm not talking about myself.
I hear.
All you. Those others.
All right.
So I have a bunch of problems with this. Like, you know, okay, maybe it makes sense for a company like Woolworths because, you know, you can maybe get down to the nuggets and, you know, nuts and bolts. And this is a rather slow moving business. Therefore, you can kind of model it, and therefore you can kind of estimate what it should do. And therefore, if it's in that ballpark, it's okay. If it's not, then it's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I get it. For many growth businesses, there are so many levers that if one thing changes a little bit, it can go up. One thing changes a little bit, it can go down.
Mm-hmm.
Just have to realize that. And therefore, you know, if you take this middle point, somehow that is miraculously going to capture what the company is going to do that half or that full year, is just, you know, it's just basically ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is, and then corporate CEOs actually fall for this, because as more and more people start following a company, corporate CEOs then feel out. Darn. I now need to treat these people, keep them happy, because these guys are going to write notes and set price targets.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I somehow need to manage these people. So their job, instead of managing company, becomes managing the analysts. This is completely bizarre. Like, I mean, you know, CEO's job is not to manage analysts. I mean, sure, talk to them, answer their questions, but come on, you don't have to manage them. But this is what happens, you know. So the corporate CEOs then start giving guidance, which, you know, tends, you know, pushes them, you know, in these questions and analyst calls about color is basically, you know, tell me that input parameter that I should put to my Excel model so that, you know, I can get the answer I want to get. So everybody's feeding them answers, and it becomes a big game, right? And the CEOs are then trying to nudge the estimates towards what it should they think they're going to deliver. And then the analyst community realizes, oh, these guys are, you know, constantly beating them because maybe, you know, they're sandbagging here. So we are going to up the estimates, and eventually they're going to miss, right?
Yep.
And the saga continues.
Yep.
So it is a bizarre song and dance that I just never understand. I mean, why can't you just think about what the business is going to do over a little bit longer periods of time and just focus on the opportunities that lie ahead?
Yeah.
Not this quarter, not this half, not even this full year.
I completely agree. Although I will say, you know what? The longer I've been in this game, the less absolute I am about anything. And I have to say, for what it's worth, I will give our fund management, our traditional analytical brethren, a little bit of, if not credit, at least a little bit of sympathy here, because we know that investment cash is super, super flighty, right? So we would say, as investors, we should stick with company X for years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Many of our buy recommendations at ShareAdvisor are 4, 5, 6, 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And we do stick with those companies for years. When you're investing in a fund, or sorry, for most fund managers, their investors tend to hang around for months, maybe a couple of years if you're lucky. And they look at every quarterly result and say, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And so at some level, there is that sense of, you've got to try and stay, you know, keep the wolf from the door, right? You've got to stay one step ahead of everybody else who says, well, if you don't get this right this quarter, I'm taking my money and going somewhere else. Now, they're the paymasters you have. We're very fortunate at The Motley Fool that our paymasters are our members and the Brothers Gardner, who all as a group believe in long-term investing. And so we've been able to cultivate and grow an approach as investors that give us that extra time frame to invest well over multiple year time frames. And so we have a business that supports us. We have members who support us and who say, I get it, we're here for the long term. It may not be always comfortable, but we know what's going on. So we do get a little bit of, it's not a free kick at all, but we get a little bit more leeway than some of our fund management brethren do, who have to try and deliver a 90-day, God help them, like,
how
you deliver a 90-day number is beyond me. You just can't know where the market's going. It's got to be three parts luck to one part skill over that short a time period. They may disagree with me, of course, and they have to, because that's how they generate their salaries, by convincing everybody they can do these things regularly. I think that's a really, really difficult thing to support and to substantiate. But I feel a little bit sorry for them. So, look, I think you're right, Doc. It is madness to try and think about quarterly or half-yearly numbers and somehow pretend that it matters enough to a long-term investment thesis. The thing is, you know what? Even if you were short, if you said, oh, I don't want to be a long-term investor, I want to be a short-term investor, the reality is it's simply so hard to do. You know, that's the other thing. We're not long-term investors because we say we don't care. We can make money in the short term, but we don't want to. We just don't believe it's possible regularly to beat the market over short time periods because you're trying to guess where the market's going far, far more than what the companies themselves are doing. Because in the short term, as Ben Graham would say, the father of value investing and Warren Buffett's mentor, in the short term, the market is a voting machine, right? You're trying to judge the short-term mood of a crowd. So what are investors going to think in 3 weeks' time? Bugged if I know. But over the long term, and while we are long-term investors, over the long term, the value of the business will have much more impact on the price rather than just the general mood. And that's why we do like to invest long-term, why the idea of companies missing estimates or beating estimates is crazy. I would say, for what it's worth, mate, I've said it before, wouldn't have the likes of Woolworths and others giving guidance. I think giving guidance is a complete waste of time. It just feeds that cycle of just madness around earnings seasons and all that kind of stuff. For what it's worth, lastly, what I will say again, though, is the share price of a company moves not relative to the results, but relative to what the market as a whole expected. Even if the analyst didn't have a particular expectation, when you buy a share hoping that the future will be look a certain way, if it isn't that way when you get there, you're either going to say, wow, it's even better, which is great, or gee, it's worse, I'm maybe reassessing my assessment of value. So at some level, I think there is an element of, you know, I like to call result season estimate season, because it's very much a matter of, you know, did it grow on last year? Well, who really cares? It's far more important whether or not it beat or missed estimates, which is a real shame and I think a bastardization of the capital markets for what it's worth.
Mm-hmm. Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I'm going to go, you mentioned dollar cost averaging, so I'm going to go to our mailbag because we had a question from Nick during the week, or last week actually it was, and Nick said, hello gents, a quick question for the podcast. I often hear about the strategy of dollar cost averaging, but how do I do it? This might seem like a silly question, it's not by the way, but practically speaking, how much do I need to invest and how often? And for example, if I have $500 to invest each month, am I picking one quality stock to continually invest in, or am I diversifying and averaging the market? Thanks in advance, Nick. This is awesome. We don't do this often enough, Doc. I think we try to. There's the investing theory, and then there's the how the hell do I put that into practice?
Right.
And this is Nick's question. So Nick gets the concept of dollar cost averaging, which is great. And for those who don't necessarily understand the concept, the idea is that if you're investing money regularly through high and low markets, you're going to effectively average out your buy price across many, many, many months, and in theory, many, many share prices. So the price you're buying for today is less relevant than the average of all the buys you make over the next 5, 10, 15 years, frankly. And that has a much greater impact. And so that's, you think about the GFC, when people say the market hasn't recovered its GFC highs or whatever they say, that's true, but only if the only 2 points you're comparing are those 2 points. If you've been buying shares every month, you got to buy, yes, some at the highs, but you got to buy a heap at the lows as well. And so your average price actually came down as share prices fell. And so your dollar cost averaging into the market. Doc, that's the explanation of the term. Tell me how you go about doing it.
Okay. So I'll just use this example and just say what I might do in this case. Again, this is all general advice. So not specific. Again, I don't know Nick's situation. So if it is me and I have $500 to invest each month, I'd first look at my brokerage fees. If my brokerage fees is like $10, what I would be, inclined to do is to combine 2 months. You could, pay $10 on top of 500, but I'd rather pay $10 on top of, or out of 1,000. So I'd combine 2 months.
Okay.
So I'd add money over 2 months and then I would invest $1,000.
Right.
Now, there are multiple ways of going about this. Let's assume that you have a portfolio of companies, then you wouldn't spend $1,000. You wouldn't divide $1,000 across, say, 10 companies, because then you'll only have $100 to invest across 10 companies. That's too small, right? So what you'd do is you could pick one company that you want to increase your weighting to or your position size for, and then you just buy that. right? And, you know, next couple of months later, you might buy something else, right? And you're basically dollar cost averaging into different companies. This is not quite exactly theoretically what you're saying, but that's one way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Another, you know, in the very simplest instance, if you've got, you know, if you're just starting out, you could just start by buying an ETF, a market ETF. And yes. If you bought a market ETF.
An ETF is?
An ETF is basically a basket of shares that you can buy in one lot. So somebody has put together a basket of shares. They're typically following an index. You could have an index that, you know, essentially mimics the Australian stock market, or you can have an index that mimics the NASDAQ 100 and so on. So you could then you're basically buying essentially effectively portions of those businesses indirectly through this, you know, like it's like buying basically a fund, but on the share market, right? And if you're doing that, and if you're investing starting out and you have small amounts of money, then you can buy that. And then you can effectively do this every couple of months. You basically just buy the same fund, as long as you know, and your fund is giving you diversification because you're holding multiple things together. That would be my way of starting out, you know. So you know, across the full, we've got a few recommendations. We have got the total stock market recommendation at one of our newsletters. We've got the NASDAQ 100 recommendation across a couple of newsletters. These things we can buy easily across the ASX. They're all trade on the ASX, and this you can just buy every 2 months.
Yep.
The same dollar amount, different amount. Number of shares based on where the share price is. And that probably would be how I would actually do it.
Right. Just to that last point you made too is a really important one. So if you're putting $1,000 per trade, whether it's every month, couple of months, quarter, whatever it is, and the share price is higher, you simply get fewer shares or fewer securities. If the price is lower, you get more of them. And that exactly, again, is the concept of dollar cost averaging, right? You're not buying 500 shares every period and you're paying whatever you're paying. Putting the same amount of money in a place, you're buying more shares, you're getting a greater proportional ownership when the share price is lower. And that's, again, another kind of example of dollar cost averaging. Doc, I'm going to add to your response with a third idea, and that is just to kind of extend Nick's time horizon a little bit. So when we say dollar cost averaging, we don't necessarily mean buying 24 tranches of the same company over 24 months.
Mm-hmm.
To your point about splitting into 10, we wouldn't suggest that at all. So at the very extreme, that would be, frankly, if that was available, that might actually be a cool way to do it. If there was a service that offered that, maybe it's worth doing. If you could put, you know, $10 here, $15 there into 20 different companies and buy a bit every time, that'd make a heap of sense. I'm going to extend the time horizon out 5 or 10 years and to say that if you think about where your portfolio is going to be in 10 years' time, you probably don't want to have bought a different company every month for that 10-year period, or you end up with 120 companies, right? I know you said every 2 months, Doc, but I'm just going to keep the math simple. Maybe you do 120 companies, but you probably don't. You probably want a portfolio with maybe 15, 20, 30 companies over that 10-year period. But if you've had a chance to buy 120 different, make 120 different transactions, there's different times you can be adding to those individual companies over time as time rolls forward. And so thinking about, if that just, again, just using very simple math, let's say 30 companies, that means you can buy each on average 4 times or so. And you won't necessarily do that because they won't be good value at different times or you've changed your mind. But that gives you plenty of opportunities to add to all of the companies in your portfolio at different times. And so part of the dollar cost averaging story isn't so much even on a per company basis. It's just that overall, whenever you're buying, if the whole market is down as it is in October, it's 31st as we record this, so it's still October. Market was down about 8% or so for October. When you bought anything at the end of October, you simply bought, on average, at an 8% lower price than you would have if you bought it last month. And so that, again, is dollar cost averaging, not per security, per company, but across your portfolio. When you're buying shares, when shares as a whole tend to be lower, you're getting a better price. When you're buying them at where shares as a whole tend to be higher, you're getting a slightly less attractive price, but you're buying fewer shares in doing it. And again, that's dollar cost averaging in play. So I love Nick's question. I think it's awesome. We would say broadly, invest regularly, invest often. Do it regularly as in timeframes and keep doing it. So whether it's 6 times a year, 12 times a year, 4 times a year, the very fact of doing it regularly rather than saving up 10 grand over 2 years and putting it all in the market at one point, that's what we're talking about here. You don't need to be so specific, Nick. I love the question. It's a great question, great concept. But just don't feel constrained to do it per company per month. Think broadly about a long-term approach and across your entire portfolio. And then the invest regularly piece, that's the far more important bit than what you're buying when you do.
Yeah, I love the invest regularly piece a lot. You know why? Because, you know, if you try to save up, you save up $5,000. It's so easy to look at that $5,000 and say, oh, let me just spend it on something else.
It really is. Do you know what I found as well, mate, for what's worth? I have very few times when I have a large amount of cash in my portfolio because I tend to like to be almost zero cash. I like to be fully invested. The 10 times I tend to have a lot of cash are either if I haven't bought anything for a while or I've sold something and drops a decent amount of cash in my portfolio. In that scenario, the higher that dollar value is, the harder I find to actually buy anything at all, because it feels like it's a bigger impact on my overall portfolio by putting that money to work. If I've got 20% cash, all I've got to try and invest that money, it's like, that's a large amount of money. Where I invest that now really matters in terms of my long-term investment performance. If I've got a couple hundred bucks, $1,000, and I'm putting that to work, and it's a smaller proportion of my portfolio, it just doesn't have as big a mental impact, as big a psychological impact of putting that to work. I actually find it easier to invest small amounts than large amounts anyway, for what it's worth.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, we're going to finish off with one last question. And we got this one. This is the immediacy of our podcast, mate. We are responsive, if nothing else. We got a request on Twitter only 8 minutes ago during this podcast from The Steady Investor at Bogle_Investor. I think Bogle_Investor. My wife owns shares in a company, but if she sells them for a capital loss and we buy them back in our joint account the same day, is this legally permissible?
You know what? I actually don't know the answer.
No, so I have no idea. Neither of us are tax experts. So it is legally permissible. Absolutely. The question I think you're getting at, Steady Investor, is what are the tax implications of that? And I think that's one. Now, we're not tax experts. We don't claim to be. My first and very best answer is ask your accountant or find a good accountant and ask them. These are really important questions that involve large amounts of money and frankly involve the tax man, and he really, really dislikes it when you do the wrong thing. So the first very specific piece of advice is go, please, and get personal advice. As a general rule, though, a couple of thoughts. The first is the ATO has very, very broad what they call anti-avoidance powers. I think it's Section 5 of the Tax Act, but I could be wrong there. The ATO basically is allowed to bring an action against you, and will choose to if they decide to, based on if they believe your actions were specifically undertaken to avoid tax. It's a little bit like the SMSFs, right? The decision when you make a decision on the SMSF, it has to be for the sole purpose of your retirement income, your retirement nest egg. In this case, the reverse or some version of it is true with tax. If the ATO believes and can convince a court you've done something with the specific intention of avoiding tax, they can come at you for penalties, recovery of the tax money, interest, and the whole lot. I won't claim to talk for the tax man. What I will say is if someone said to me, hey, I'm going to do this, I'm going to sell my shares and then buy them back in our joint names over here the same day or even a week or even a month later, at some point, if the ATO believes it can make a case that you have done it to specifically minimize or avoid tax, actually minimize is okay, avoid is the problem. If they decide you've done it to avoid tax, they will, if they think it's big enough and worth it, bring an action against you. So I would counsel against that as a general rule. Again, please seek your own professional advice. But because those anti-avoidance powers, there's nothing specifically to say you can or can't necessarily, but those are very, very broad, wide-ranging, sweeping, all those great euphemisms, powers that the ATO has, and they can absolutely knock on the door and say, hey, we think you did that for tax avoidance reasons, to minimize your tax unfairly, inappropriately, and we'd like that money back, plus some penalties, plus some interest, thank you very much. Look, generally speaking, my view on tax, and this is a personal view, my view on tax is if you think you might be too close to the line, you probably are. There's a whole lot of things that are, well, there's almost nothing worth going to jail for, maybe a few million bucks. But generally speaking, you just don't want to get, you know, this is a very personal view. I just don't want to take the risk, right? I don't really feel like having to try and justify to the ATO what's going on. I don't want to have to pay penalties. I don't want to have action, criminal, civil taken against me. It's just not worth it, right? The risk people take none of us want to pay more tax than we have to, but man, like there's better ways to spend time and frankly, money. Than defending a lawsuit from the ATO and possibly facing civil or criminal actions. Just not much fun. Doc, do you have anything to add to that one?
No.
All right. Fools, all things being equal, and that's a big call, I will be back next week with Doc. If my Kokoda Trek has done badly, maybe Doc will be here by himself, or you may have another guest speaker. But we'll assume that everything's gone okay. We'll assume that I am not far from boarding a plane. And if that's the case, Doc and I will be back with you next week. But before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the MMM Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And please give us a rating, throw us some stars, let other people know that you like our podcast. We kind of think it's a bit of fun. We like doing it and we want to share it with more people. That's one key way. If you're enjoying this, you can do us a little bit of a favor and help other people find it as well. Well, that's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week, as I said, good Lord willing and the creeks don't rise, with another dose of foolish insight. Full on.
Full on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.